Okay, let's get started. So welcome to 377. I will be the instructor for your course. My name is Prashant, and what I hope to do today is give you all a flavor of what this course is about, what we hope to achieve through the semester, and what you should be keeping an eye out in terms of assignments and so on, what they will involve. Okay, so it's mostly an organizational meeting with syllabus. I'll go through the syllabus and so on. Maybe in the last 20 minutes or so, we'll do a quick introduction to operating system, mostly a history lesson rather than any technical details. Okay, so let's start with course information. So there is a course web page. You don't have to write this down. You can go to my web page, and there will be a link to this page. I'll show you the page in just a moment. I will be posting the lecture notes. All the slides that I typically show you in class will be posted on the course page, typically maybe half an hour before the lecture. If you want to print those lecture notes and bring them to class, you can. Okay. The course is being recorded, so I will put up at least audio and most probably also video lectures. Okay. It's not a reason to not come to class. Okay. It's a reason to get more out of this class, so you can go back, review material and so on. Okay. All of that will be available on the web page. There is also a Moodle page for the class. I don't know if you have heard of Moodle. It's the system that is replacing the old Spark system. Okay. So it's called Moodle. There is a page on that system. That's where we will be asking you to turn in all of your work. Okay. So typically you will not hand in any paper copies. Any homeworks you will turn in there, any assignment code you will upload there. This way everything is tracked, nothing gets lost. Okay, and we will have, you will be getting your grades on Spark, I mean not Spark, but it's now called Moodle. On Moodle as well, I'll show you the Moodle page also in just a moment. Okay, that's my email. This is what you can always use to send me questions about the course. There's also a discussion forum on Moodle that I'll show you as well. Okay, TA for this course is Sean. Okay, Sean is right here. He is going to also have office hours. He is going to be your primary resource for the lab component of the course. Okay, it's a 4-credit class. The substantial programming and lab component. Sean is going to be leading the discussion sections where you will get lots of help and information about the lab component, and he is the primary person you go to when you have problem. You can always come to me, of course, but he is going to be spending quite a bit of time with you on the programming assignments and whatnot. Okay, there is also a discussion section that's held on Wednesdays from 1:15. Sean, is it 1:10 or 1:15? 1:10 to 2:10 or 2:15, something like that. And it's 1:25. Okay, excuse me. It's 1:25. It's a 1 hour, 50-minute discussion section. It's in ELAB 304, not in this class. Okay, there will be a discussion section tomorrow. Okay, just to get you guys started off, and you are required to go to the discussion section, because almost every week we are going to do a brief quiz. Okay, the quizzes will be graded. There's not a whole lot of credit, but there's a little bit of credit, so there's some incentive for you to go to the discussion section. And basically we will be reviewing material you do in the lectures. Okay, you will do problem solving there. You will learn more about programming assignments, get help and so on. Okay, so don't just think that it's sufficient to come to the lectures and not go to the discussion section. There's a good reason to go there. You will learn a lot more. Okay, and get a lot more out of this class. Okay, there are seats back there if you want to. Okay, so there's a prerequisite for this course, which is CompSci 230. Okay, I presume most of you have taken this class already. If you have not, please come talk to me at the end of the lecture. Okay, there has to be, typically you won't be able to get into this course if you haven't taken 230 already. Okay, but there are a couple of books that we'll be using. There's a primary textbook, which is Operating System Concepts by Silverschatz. is the same book that has been used for this course for a number of years. It is now in its 8th edition. Okay. Feel free to, if you get a used 7th edition which is cheaper, feel free to buy that. There is not a whole lot of difference. Okay, they keep coming out with new editions just so that they can keep the price high, but the material is not very different. Okay, so there isn't a whole, this is the official recommended book, but I am perfectly happy to have you buy the 7th edition if you want. I'll have a couple of these copies also in the library as reference copies. If you don't want to buy the book and just want to get by going to the library, that's fine too. Okay. There are a couple of other books that are useful, and one is this Operating Systems in Depth. It's a little more systems oriented book. There's more programming focus in this book. This, the Silbershad book, focuses more on concepts. This one is a bit more systemsy. It's more of a reference book. You don't have to buy this. I will also have copies of this in the library. Occasionally I may use material from this book. If I do that, I will hand out some photocopies, because we won't use it extensively. You don't have to buy it. Okay. There's a third book that's also useful, which is Modern Operating System by Tannenbaum. Again, same thing. You don't have to buy it. I'll have reference copies in the library. But between these three, I think we can get by. Okay. So if you just need to have one book, this is the one to get. Okay. The Silbershad's book. Okay. As far as course requirements there will be homeworks, programming assignments, and exams. Okay. I have put 6, but we may do anywhere from 4 to 6 homeworks and some quizzes in the discussion section. Collectively, that will be 15% of the grade. Okay. And the homeworks are not going to be heavy duty. They are just a means to ensure that you keep up with the course. Okay. They make you read the material so that you can answer some question. Otherwise, you only come to the book when it's time for the midterm. Okay, we don't want to do that. We want you to keep up as we go along. Okay, so it's 15%, 3 to 4 programming assignments. I put 4, but depending on how it goes, it may be either 3 or 4. Okay, and that's a substantial component of the course. It's 45% of the total grade. There'll be 3 exams, with 2 midterms and a final. That's around 40% of the grade. Okay. So as you can see, there is quite a bit of work involved. It's a 4-credit course, so you have to expect that the amount of work that you'll put into the course is a little more than a typical 3-credit class. Okay. And are there any questions here before I move on to some other policies? Okay. So there are late policies that we have put up in the syllabus. There's a policy on cheating and whatnot that you should all be aware of. Please go read it. I'll come back to the policy on cheating, because there's a small assignment there that you have to do today. Okay. But let me talk about the labs in a little more detail. So there is a Ed Lab, as you probably know. There are machines there that you can use to do the assignments. If you have your own machine, which is very likely, you are welcome to use that. You don't have to go to the EdLab. Okay? All of the submission is electronic, so you can pretty much get by not visiting the EdLab if you plan to use your own laptop, okay, to do the work. Okay? Do go to the discussion section, because that's where a lot of the information about the assignments will be given out, okay, programming assignments. Okay? As far as office hours are concerned, my office hours will be immediately before class in my office, which is in this building, room 336. You can always come see me at other times, but I request the courtesy of at least an email so that I can tell you if I'm busy with a meeting or some such thing. Okay. Sean will also have office hours on Mondays and Fridays, right? Do you have times yet?
Okay.
Okay, so we will announce the times. So I will have office hours on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Sean will have office hours on Monday and Friday. So 4 of the 5 days of the week, there is someone available to help you. Okay? Wednesdays are the discussion section, so you can get help anyway by going to the discussions. So there's plenty of help available if you need it. Okay? So do make use of it. Typically, nobody comes to office hours until it's time for the exam. Okay, so if you want to come see me or Sean, please do so. You'll get more out of the course. Okay. Already mentioned programming projects, 45%. As a late policy, typically we don't accept late assignments. Since everything is submitted online, we can track and the system will cut you off. Okay, so I will basically put in a deadline and you won't be able to submit. Okay, and there are exceptions to this which include medical emergencies, family emergencies and so on, and those are spelled out in the syllabus. Okay. Projects, the code, the programming assignment, which we also call projects, will be in Java. Okay, that's what we have been doing for a number of years. Until recently, I think the course has gone back and forth between using standalone programming assignments and using this system called Nachos. I have taught both flavors of the course. This time around, I may do a little bit of both. The Nacho system is a toy operating system written in Java. Doing programming assignments in Nachos helps you understand some of the details, but we see that students find it hard to use because it's a large system programming, large system, and making minor modifications and having problems is not always easy to deal with. So what we will do is probably have one of the three or four assignments in Nachos, which is where we can go into the nitty-gritties and learn a little bit about what operating systems are like underneath. Okay. The others will be more standalone assignments where you don't have to go and muck around with somebody else's code. You do your own code, okay, as far as the assignment is concerned. Okay. But everything will be in Java. Okay. Is there any comments or questions about the assignments? Of course, we will give out the assignments as we go along and they will reflect what we are doing in the lectures. Okay. There will be one assignment on processes and threads. That's the first main component of the course. There's going to be one on either memory management or file systems, most likely on file systems. And then there will be one on distributed systems. That's the last component of the course. Okay, that will be a new assignment that I'm still designing, but it might have some elements of cloud computing and things like this, which you may have heard of. Okay? Those are nice concepts to know, and there's no better way to learn them than by doing something with it. Okay, so that's the assignments. As far as the plagiarism is concerned, as I mentioned, there's a strict policy on cheating. Okay, so it's all spelled out. I'm not going to go into all the gory details, but there are some obvious things you should and shouldn't be doing. And just so that we know that you read it, what we would like you to do is take the assignment, plagiarism policy, sign it and just upload it to Moodle. Okay, so this way you at least know how to upload your assignment to Moodle, and you won't come to me at 4:55 on a Friday saying Moodle is not allowing me to upload my files. Okay, so please do that, and so that way we know you have read it and you also know how to use Moodle. Okay, as far as cell phones and laptops go, cell phones typically tend to go off during class. It's very annoying and distracting, so please try to put them on silent mode if you have to bring them to class. And as far as laptops and tablets go, we have had different policies. I know several of you have machines here right now, and some of you actually use it to do work and some of you use it to do Facebook because you are bored. Okay, and that is incredibly distracting to others. So the typical policy is that we don't allow it during class. Okay, if you want to use it to take notes, you have to come talk to me and I have to make an exception, because the rule is that we won't do it. During discussions, you can always use it because we will be actually doing work most sometimes on your laptops. Okay, but as far as lectures go, I think I would appreciate it if you actually don't have your laptops open, because I'm pretty sure your mind will drift off and you will distract not only yourself but others sitting around you. Okay? This way you will get more out of the course, and basically so will your neighbors who sit around you. Okay. Now, as far as the course itself is concerned, those are all the policies that we have with regards to the course. Actually, before I go into the topics, just want to show you two things. So that's the course page. That's the link that I just mentioned to you. It is going to be on my web page, so you can just go from there and you will basically know it soon. Anyway, so the syllabus that I have been talking about is all spelled out in gory details here. So do look at that and make sure you understand all of the policies and projects policies and so on. And then the other thing is the course schedule, which is not up yet, will have all of the lecture notes, including my PowerPoint or keynote slides, okay? As well as lots of other material, including links to the audio podcasts of this course, video lectures and all that kind of stuff. Okay, that will be posted here. The lab section will have all the labs, yeah, needless to say. Okay, so if you go also to the Moodle page, which is moodle.umass.edu, okay, as I said, that's the new incarnation of Spark. Spark has been discontinued by the university. Moodle is the new learning management system. So if you log in, you will basically, you should, if you are registered, see 377 in there. You go to the 377 page, this is what it looks like. So as you can see, I put a link to the course page, that's the other page I was just showing you. There is that policy, that's your assignment, which is to upload the signed version of your collaboration policy there. Okay, so if you click there, it will allow you to upload something, or hopefully it should. So you go there, you upload a file. Okay. And all the assignments will be handed out on Moodle, and you have to submit them through Moodle. Okay, so it's essential that you at least access it and make sure it allows you in. Because if for some reason there's some problem with your registration, this is the time to get that sorted out. Any questions on anything I've said so far? Yes. Oh, the question is, do you have to bring your laptop during discussion? You don't have to. If we require, because we are not assuming that every one of you will have a laptop, but we might do some things that might help if you have the laptop with you, but it's not required. Okay, so you can always go back and do things. If you are working on a project and you have certain questions, you want to ask Sean a question or show him something, it may help to bring your laptop in and show this is what's happening, that kind of stuff. Okay, so you don't have, it's not required. Okay, but that's the only place I think we will allow it, because there are legitimate users there. That's all I meant to say. Any other questions? Okay. So as far as the course topics and outline are concerned, that's the order in which we are going to go through the course, the same order as in the textbook. So the first quarter of the course is going to focus on processes and threads, and that is going to include what is a process, what are threads, what is concurrency, some elements of synchronization. Some of this you must have gone through in 230. Okay, we will go through some more in-depth aspects of this material here, okay, as it relates to operating systems. Okay. Next component of the course is going to be on memory management. This is how your operating system manages the RAM on your machine. Okay. Important aspects of operating system. So quite a few topics there, including demand paging, virtual memory and things like that. Okay. Third component is storage and file systems. Okay, this is where we look at how the operating system manages various storage devices. The primary one happens to be the hard disk on your machine, but there are many other storage devices, CD-ROMs, USB drives, SSD drives and so on, solid state disks and so on. So we look at storage and file systems. Okay. The last component is distributed systems. This is basically what kinds of functionality an operating system provides you so that you can communicate. You or the applications that run on your machine communicate. Okay, whether it's the web or email, practically any application that you use today are networked in some shape or form. There are some things that the operating system needs to do to enable that functionality. So we'll look at what the OS does as well as how the applications use that functionality. Okay, so four key components. Each is going to take approximately a quarter of the course. Okay, maybe some a little more and some a little less. Okay, so that's basically what the course is about. What I want to do now is talk a little bit about what is an operating system at a very high level, define what it means, what we get out of studying this topic, as well as do a quick history lesson. Okay, as I said, it's a short class today. We are not going to use up our entire hour in 15 minutes. okay? So I'm going to go through a quick history lesson and then end the class, and then but I'll stick around if you have questions about registration and whatnot. Okay? So let's start with the definition of what is an OS. Okay, there's no one definition. There are many of them. So you can basically think of it as the interface that sits between the user, i.e. you, and the underlying hardware, that is your machine. Okay? So it's a piece of software that is essentially sitting between the user and the hardware. Okay? So you may ask, why do you need it? Okay, why can you not directly use the functionality on your hardware? What does the operating system provide you? So essentially why you need it is, you can also think of it as a piece of software that provides a easier to use interface to the underlying resources on your machine. Okay? So the operating system deals with lots of the hard parts about where to store your data, how to get it back from the disk and so on. You don't need to worry about it. It gives easier to use abstraction. Okay? One such abstraction is that of a file. Okay? So when you create a file and you write something into that file, the operating system deals with all the issues of where do you put this file on disk, how do you account for how much data is in it when you open that file again, how do you go back to the disk, figure out where the data is, bring it back to the application and so on. You don't need to worry about it. You don't tell the OS saying, go to this location on disk and go and fetch the data that's stored there. The OS is figuring all of that out for you. All you need to know is the name of the file, which if you remember, and you can just specify that and the OS takes care of that. That is what I mean by an abstraction. Okay? That's what the operating system has done for you. It's made your life easier in some sense. There are many such abstractions that the operating system will provide you. Okay? It allows you to run multiple applications or processes at the same time. Okay? Something we call multi-programming. You don't need to deal with, all you do is you open your applications and the operating system figures out which apps are running and which ones are you using at any time, how do you arbitrate all the hardware resources across them and so on and so forth. So you just get on with your work and the OS is dealing with all of the details of the underlying hardware management and so on. Okay? So it's essentially, so this abstraction is also can be thought of as what we call a virtual machine. Okay? And we'll come back to this concept of a virtual machine as we go along in this course. So it's a virtual machine that is easier to program than the hardware. It provides easier to use abstractions than the raw hardware. Okay? So this is what Microsoft thinks what the operating system is, because an operating system when you talk about Windows or you talk about a Mac OS or Linux for that matter, it's more than what we will actually look at. Okay? When we say operating system, we are actually referring to the operating system kernel. Okay? That's the smallest component that sits on top of the hardware. But there are lots of pieces that are layered on top of it. Okay, that actually run in user space that are not part of the kernel. So when you talk about Windows or you talk about Mac OS X, there are lots of other pieces that come with what is now referred to as an operating system. Okay? But here we are only going to focus on the design of the operating system kernel, not all of the other pieces. There is a GUI component that allows you to interact using Windows and whatnot. So we are not going to look at the windowing system, for instance. We are not going to look at a whole bunch of other things that are outside the operating system kernel. Okay? So we have to distinguish between, when we say OS in this class, we typically mean the OS kernel, not all of the pieces that go with it. Okay? Then in some cases, even web browsers are considered to be part of the OS, but not in our view. Okay? So here is a picture that shows what I was just saying. Okay, this is your raw hardware, that's your machine, that's your laptop, or it could be your tablet or your smartphone. Okay? The OS is a piece of software that's running on the bare bones machine. Okay? And then what you applications and users see is the abstraction that the OS is providing. Okay? And lots of the details of the underlying hardware get hidden by the OS. You don't actually see it, you don't have to deal with it. Okay? The OS deals with it. Okay? So this makes your job of using the machine to do some useful task much easier. Okay? So it's the interface between the user and the architecture. It implements a virtual machine abstraction that's easier to use, easier to program than the raw hardware. Okay? It also provides some illusions of being bigger, faster and more reliable. Okay? The operating system can do interesting things for you. Okay? For one such thing is what we call virtual memory. Okay? Your machine may have, let's say, 4 gigabytes of RAM. An operating system implements an abstraction called virtual memory. So applications don't see this limitation at all. Okay? You can start as many apps as you want. Even if the total size of the apps that are resident exceed the size of RAM, they still continue to run. Okay, so the operating system takes this physical limitation and removes it, okay, by using extra space on disk in this case. Okay? We will come back to when we do memory management, we will see how this virtual memory abstraction is implemented. Okay? So what this has done is it's taken away some of the limitations that the hardware presents, and it's giving an illusion as if there is no limit on RAM at all. You can start as many processes you want, start as many applications. It doesn't matter whether you have 1 gigabyte of RAM or 4, they continue to run. They may run slower, but they will run. The operating system won't say, you used up your 2 GB of RAM, so I can't start up any more apps. Okay? If you did not have this abstraction, then you would be limited by the size of RAM. Yeah, early versions of operating systems actually place this limitation. If you started too many apps, then you start one more, it will say, I can't start this because there is no RAM to start this app. Okay? Today, some smartphones still have these limitations. If you have iOS, it doesn't have virtual memory. If you start too many apps, it actually goes and removes some of them that are running. If you actually look at the logs, you will see some of these things happening in the back. You are not aware of it typically because it hides this nicely and it doesn't make it look ugly, but this is what's happening. Okay? So it gives you illusions of being bigger, faster and more reliable. By more reliable, you can actually have operating systems that can mask hardware faults. Okay, by implementing interesting optimizations in software. Even if some pieces of the hardware fail, the machine as a whole may continue to run. Okay, this is important in servers. Okay, it may not be important for your laptop, but in servers that are running very important critical applications like whether it's Google or Amazon, you don't want the service to come down. Your OS can provide you interesting reliability optimization so that failure of any single piece of hardware doesn't bring the whole system down. Okay? We won't go into the reliability aspects of operating systems in this course. That is material for a graduate class in operating systems, but I just wanted to mention that the OS can do certain things like reliability. Okay? Okay, now, so this is all great, so but what do you give up for it? Okay, so there is something, nothing comes for free, so there's something you have to give up. Okay, so the thing that you give up is so the extra overhead that the operating system has imposed on you. Okay? Because it's a piece of software that has to sit between the application, there is always an overhead because any interaction between the applications and the underlying hardware have to go through the operating system. If you want to access a file that sits on the disk, which is a piece of hardware, that request has to go through the OS. You can't just go and directly access the raw data sitting on disk. Okay? That is going to impose some overheads. Okay? That what that means is your machine will run a bit slower than if there was no OS at all. Okay? So you get all these conveniences, but it comes at a cost. Okay? And the more functionality the operating system provides, the more is going to be the overhead. Okay? As you can imagine, sometimes new versions of operating systems come out and you install a new version and you say my machine is slow. That's because they pack more functionality that comes at a cost, which is higher overhead. And the machine very slows down because now there's more stuff to deal with as far as the OS is concerned. Okay? So, now, the field of operating system continues to be an active area of research. There are many people that are doing research, but here when I say research, I am taking a much broader view of operating system, not just operating systems kernel. Relatively little work is actually happening on designing new kernels. Okay, most of that work is happening in industry, and you heard of most of the companies that do that. Okay, this is either Microsoft, it develops the Windows kernel, or Apple that does OS X, or the open source community that does Linux. Okay. But the area itself is much broader than kernel design. There are lots of other interesting aspects of operating system, and that itself is a very active area of research. There's lots of work happening, lots of optimization. The cloud computing is one such area which you may have heard of, very active area of research right now. There are several others. There's another one called grid computing, which is somewhat related to cloud computing, another important area of research. About 10 years ago, web-based systems were an active area of research. They still are, but it was very hot in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Okay? So new areas in this field keep emerging and people keep coming up with new innovations. Okay? There are this whole class of devices called embedded devices which run very tiny kernels. Okay? There are very small devices, they run very small operating systems. That's another area of research. How to make operating systems smaller and smaller so they run on smaller pieces of hardware. Okay? And then there is this whole open source movement that you probably have heard of, Linux being one of the main success stories there. There are many others, of course. We'll talk a little bit about Linux as we go along. Okay. So as far as OS features are concerned, there are several ways to think about what an operating system provides you. One way to think of it is it provides a set of services. Okay, the services allow you to do a variety of things. So there's a file service that allows you to access the storage. There's a virtual memory service that allows you to run applications and it manages the RAM for you. There's a networking service that allows you to network with other machines, run distributed applications. There's time sharing and so on. So variety of interesting services. We'll go through several of them in a lot more detail as we go along. Okay. But the other interesting thing that we'll also look at is the issue of coordination. Okay. How does the operating system arbitrate between applications? Okay. If two applications want to do something at the same time, how does the operating system decide in what order things happen? Okay. And coordination is important in variety of contexts, concurrency being one. Okay. If you actually presumably you all did some threads programming in 230. Yes? Okay. So threads are an example of concurrency. Okay. You have multiple threads, you had shared data structures like a buffer, and when two threads try to access, read a variable, a shared variable, write to a shared variable, you basically have to have protected with a lock. Right, a semaphore or a lock, you must have done some of this. Okay? So these are all abstractions that the OS provides so that you can write correct code. Okay, the notion of a semaphore or a lock is implemented inside the operating system so that the right things happen. Okay? They are exposed to you at a very high level, maybe in the Java, using Java threads, but they use underlying OS primitives for correctness. Okay? So that's implemented inside the OS. So what we will do here is actually look at how an operating system implements threads and concurrency. How do they implement semaphores? What does the kernel have to do? Okay. Same goes with memory protection, okay, or file protection. Okay, there is a notion of protection in operating system so that one process cannot access private data, whether it's memory data or data stored on disk of another process if it is protected. Okay. How is that implemented by the operating system? How does it ensure both security and privacy? Okay. It's another issue of coordination. Okay. So security as well. So essentially what we want to do, okay, if you put all this together, what we want to do is design this piece of software, which we will call an operating system, okay, that is convenient to use as far as the user is concerned. So convenience is an important design goal, and efficient to use. So then you will see that this is often a trade-off. Okay? Sometimes you cannot actually get both always. You might have to trade off convenience for efficiency. To make something more convenient, you might have to add more code, which makes it less efficient. Okay? Or you want to make it fast, you might have to throw out some of the functionality, but that sort of will make it less convenient. Okay? So you want to have strike a balance between convenience and efficiency. And how to strike that balance well is one thing that we'll learn in this course. Okay? And that issue is not just related to operating system design. Whenever you design any large piece of software, okay, whether it's a database or a large piece of code, you often have to make design choices. And they always involve trade-offs. Okay? Should I do more or should I do less? What's the implication of adding more functionality and what is the cost? Okay, so you always have to make these design decisions, and as part of studying kernel design, we look at how to strike this balance well, okay, so that it's still useful and yet convenient, or efficient rather. Okay? So that's basically a general system design principle. So by studying operating system, we are learning something that applies to other disciplines as well, other disciplines within computer science that is as well, which is how do you make this trade-off between performance and convenience, performance and simplicity, putting functionality in hardware or software. Okay, that's another design goal. So you could put more functionality in hardware that's expensive and makes it faster, or you could do things in software which makes the hardware cheaper but then the software runs slower. Okay? So lots of design choices. Okay, how do you make these design decisions? Okay, so I already covered some of this, so I'm going to skip that slide and come back to building large computer system. Okay? So another goal of this course, although we are actually studying operating system design, is really to understand how do you take some of these ideas and apply them to building large computer systems, okay? Not just designing an OS kernel. So the design principles are general. We'll see them applied to a specific context, which is kernel design. Okay? But they are more general, and you'll see that the same principles might apply when you are designing very large distributed systems. So these could be systems like the Google search engine, which runs on hundreds of thousands of servers at this, concurrently. Okay? Or most of the large services, internet services that you see out there, are essentially distributed and they are very large. They run in multiple locations around the globe, hundreds or thousands of servers or tens of thousands of servers. And how do you write applications of that scale? Okay? How do you make them work well? How do you make them provide the right functionality to the user? So what we learn here on a small scale for the kernel design will also apply to some of these ideas. Okay? And as we progress through the course, and when we come to the last component, which is on distributed systems, we'll actually see how do you take what is essentially a single machine and a kernel and make it work across multiple machines. What functionality do you use to build some of these higher level applications? Okay. So with that quick background and definitions of what an operating system is and what does it do, we are going to go into a small history lesson, or a quick history lesson of how operating systems have worked. Okay, operating systems have been around since the early 60s. Okay, they were originally designed for mainframes. Okay, and as machines have evolved, so have the operating system kernels and the functionality that they provide to you. Okay, so the very early OSs that were out there that you sort of saw in machines were single user machines. Okay, so you had this thing called a mainframe. It was a very large piece of hardware, okay, probably the size of this room, okay, and probably had less compute power than what you have on your phone today. But that's what machines were capable of. Okay. Operating systems were very rudimentary. What they allowed you to do was one user, okay, would sit in front of that machine and program that machine, run a program. The program would compute and provide and spit out some output. And then the next user would sit there, and then they would program and they would feed their program, run it and so on. Okay? So one user at a time, completely sequential. Okay? When the user was programming, meaning writing code, essentially they used to have things called punch cards where you actually typed your program and you fed that thing in. So no keyboards. Okay? But when the user was programming, the machine was sitting there idle. Okay? Because there's nothing running on that machine, because the user is still feeding his program into the machine. Okay. So that is very expensive, very large piece of hardware costing millions of dollars, which only one user could use, and most of the time it was sitting there idle doing nothing, because the user was actually writing the code to feed it to the machine. Okay. That's all that the operating system would do. It would accept user programs, it would run that program, it would provide the output, and then it would accept the next user program. Very simple kernels, not much functionality, but also very inefficient. Okay. Now, as you can imagine, if you want to make better use of that machine, one simple thing you could do is when one user is programming the machine, some other user is actually running their program. This way you are using the hardware. One user is feeding their code and data, and the previous user's program is actually running. Okay. That way you are basically doing computation and I/O both at the same time and making better use of all of the hardware on that machine. Okay, that's essentially called multi-programming. Okay, this is basically how operating systems evolved. Okay, but before you go into multi-programming, there was another concept that operating systems came up, designers came up with, which was called batch processing. Okay. In batch processing, what you did was, rather than the user interactively typing their program into the computer, you basically took a stack of these and you fed them as a batch. Okay. And they all went into the system, they all executed one after another, and all the output came out. Not at all interactive. So this is basically what is called batch. So you load a program, you run it, print the results, and you repeat, and you basically have a set of these programs queued up, ready to run. Okay, so you all fed them, and you run one at a time, and you spit the output. And you could submit your jobs on cards, which I presume most of you not heard of what a punch card is, or tape. Okay, I'm sure most of you never seen a tape either. But those were the input devices for computers in those days. There was no real scheduling. Okay, you basically just fed them these things one job at a time. Okay, then basically came the concept of doing a little more, if you are putting in some optimizations into the kernel, so you could make a bit of better use of the machine. Okay, and this is done by overlapping I/O and computation. Okay, so if you think about what this means. Let's say you have a machine here, there's a CPU and there is a keyboard. Okay, so essentially one user is typing their program here, okay, but while you're doing that, your CPU is idle because there's nothing that is doing other than accepting input, which is not very good use of that CPU. So what you could do is run another process there while one user is feeding their program. Okay, so this is I/O and this is computation. So if you have the ability to overlap, which is have both of these activities happening at the same time, okay, you can make better use of this machine. That was the insight that this OS designers came up with. So that the CPU doesn't have to be idle while the user is typing the program, or the keyboard doesn't have to be idle while the CPU is running a program. You can use both of these pieces, components of the hardware, and make better use of your $1 million that you have spent on this computer. That's how much machines used to cost, mainframes used to cost in those days. So essentially, that allowed, so this is what operating systems evolved to. They allowed you to do this task. Okay, so that basically led to the era of multi-programming. Okay, rather than just have one process at one I/O task, you could have lots of applications running. You just generalize this idea, saying why stop at one job running on the CPU and one job doing I/O, basically allow multiple users to run their jobs simultaneously. Okay? So lots of users can log into the machine, they can all submit jobs, all these jobs run concurrently, and the OS deals with how do you allocate CPU time to these jobs, how do you allocate disk storage to these jobs, and so on and so forth. Okay? So this is what is called multi-program. Everything that I've talked about until now is called uniprogram. Uniprogramming means one program at a time. Okay? Multi-programming means you can run more than one at a time. Okay? Practically every OS you see today is in this category. Okay, you will be hard pressed to find, unless you are actually doing some embedded systems programming, okay, which is programming some tiny piece of hardware. You won't see uniprogramming. Yeah, basically, most of your general purpose kernels today fall into the multi-programming camp, because that is the best way to use the hardware on that machine. Okay. Now, although multiple users can use that machine, the OS is actually playing a very important role here. Okay. It is figuring out which jobs to run, when to run these jobs. By job, I mean a process or an application. Okay. How to run them, in what order to run them, how to protect one application's memory from another, so you don't go and corrupt some other process memory and things like that. Okay. When to resume jobs that may be waiting on I/O, and so on and so forth. Okay. Lots of interesting things have to be done in the kernel to enable multi-programming. Okay. And those are all things we'll actually study here. Okay. So as operating systems have evolved, so have their complexity. Okay. We want more functionality. The kernel grows in size, it has become more complex. There are several interesting side stories here of how operating system complexity grew and how it became unwieldy and caused lots of problems. Okay, there was a famous story about this OS called Multics. I don't know if any of you heard of it. This was an operating system that was designed in the 60s by GE, okay, with some help from MIT. They wanted to make this big operating system kernel that would have lots of functionality. Okay. They spent years and years and years and lots of people programming it. Okay, and the OS kernel became so large and so complex that it never worked at all well. Okay, it had so many bugs that nobody could get it to work. In the end, it basically just canned the whole project. And they basically wasted many years of work, probably lots and lots of money, and they basically gave up on the whole thing. Okay. And the reason I'm saying this is they made bad design choices. Okay. They didn't strike that balance I was talking about between convenience and efficiency. Okay, or convenience and simplicity. They tried to make it too complex. Okay. And as a result, they couldn't even get it to work, let alone let their users get it to work. Okay. And they had to basically give up on the whole thing. Okay. But what came out of that exercise was the first Unix operating system. Okay. So basically, some people who are working on Multics said, this is the wrong way to design operating systems. Rather than making it large and complex, let's make it small and simple. So basically, computer scientists at Bell Labs in the 70s essentially said, we are going to use a completely different design philosophy. We are not going to try to pack every possible feature you can think of into the OS. We are going to make something very tiny and simple. Okay? And they designed the first Unix, yeah, which is still around today in many flavors, as you can imagine. Okay? So you can see which design choices has won. Okay? Basically, you keep things simple. You basically get more success. Okay? But that doesn't mean that simple alone is good. As hardware evolves, you have to keep adding more functionality. But having that balance is important. You try to basically go too much in the camp of being having lots of functionality, you will get into this kind of problem. And this has nothing to do with operating system design. This is true of any, if you go do any software engineering class, you will hear the same thing, right? Good software design principles are important. You have to think carefully about what functionality to put, why to put it, is it really necessary, how to do it right. Okay, so there's all these important aspects that apply broadly to systems, software design rather, apply here as well. Okay. So here's another take on this history lesson that I was talking about. So this is what I was talking about, Multics. Okay. Lots of programmers, 6-year project, complete failure. Unix, okay, 3 computer scientists, okay, Kerning and Ritchie and someone else, I think Bob Pye, 2 years, and they wrote a piece of software that's been a big success. Okay. Every modern operating system that you see today has some legacy that goes back to Unix, including Windows. Okay, the Windows was redesigned, and at one point it actually had inherited a lot of code from a Unix project. Okay, today you can't recognize it as Unix, but it has some legacy that goes back to it. Okay, so that's basically the era of mainframes in the 60s and the rise of Unix in the 70s. And as you basically go through this history lesson, what you see is, as time goes by, hardware has started getting cheaper and cheaper. Okay? In the 80s, you could actually buy personal computers. You had to spend maybe $5,000-$10,000. Okay? Still more than what you would pay for a PC today, but not $1 million. So a lot more people could afford a computer. Okay? Because the price kept dropping. What basically that resulted in is the use of personal computers. So it's not that you have to have mainframe that sat in some room somewhere. Everyone could have one on their desk. Not everyone, but everyone who could afford to spend $10,000 could put one on their desk. And that resulted in a new era of operating systems, which were PC-based operating systems. Okay, this is where you see DOS first coming into the picture, early versions of Mac OS coming into the picture. Okay, so these are all operating systems that were designed to run on personal computers. Okay, that different feature sets from operating systems that run on servers. Okay, here usability is key. Okay, because there's a user sitting in front of the machine and directly interacting with it on a day-to-day basis. Okay, so that has resulted in the use of mouse, as a piece of hardware to interact, windowing or GUI based systems, which most server operating systems don't have. Okay? So it resulted in different design choices as far as operating systems were concerned. Okay? There are so GUIs being the most important difference between the early OSs and PC based OSs. Okay. And this trend has continued. Okay, I'll talk about Moore's law before we end the class. And this is basically hardware getting cheaper and faster is basically an outcome of Moore's law, which we'll come back to. But essentially, because of Moore's law, hardware has gotten cheaper and cheaper and faster. Okay. So what that has meant is basically, if you look at what is happening today, there are basically the traditional incarnations of machines, which are laptops and desktops. But there are lots of devices that essentially have a computer inside them, which you don't recognize them as computers anymore. Okay, because things are so cheap that you don't even think of putting in a microcontroller and calling that thing a computer. Right, so examples being your phone is a computer now, your car is a computer, okay, because it has chips, it has actually as much horsepower as your laptop, probably more. Okay. Lots of devices you have in the home are computers. Your set-top box that the cable or the satellite provider gives as essentially running Linux. You go on a airplane, you have these entertainment systems that are on the seat. Those are actually full-fledged computers. And you don't think of them as that, but that's essentially what they are. Okay? And you have this rise of sensor networks where you have very tiny devices that you now either wear or you have in the environment that are essentially full-fledged computers. Okay, you can have monitors that monitor your vital statistics that are essentially full-fledged machines. Embedded ones, but nevertheless full-fledged computers. Okay. So you have this trend which basically has made hardware so cheap that it's possible to put a machine for any particular very specific application you want. Okay, very specific ones rather than general purpose computing that laptops and tablets allow you to do. Okay, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, because machines are so cheap, you can buy lots of them even to do traditional computing tasks. Okay, this has led to the rise of cloud computing and grid computing. Okay, now, because machines are this cheap, Google can afford to put 100,000 machines or to run their search engine. It's not cheap, may cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but it's still feasible for a company of that size. Okay? So that's essentially parallel and distributed computing. You have this very large set of servers that sit in a machine room somewhere that run this highly distributed task, whether it's search engine or it's Amazon's e-commerce site or it's Facebook. All of these apps run on very large clusters. Okay? That sit in a data center somewhere. And this is again the consequence of the same trend of hardware being cheap. You can buy lots of servers, just as you can buy lots of chips and put them in lots of different applications. Okay, so this is our dated history lesson, which shows you the trends of the cost of computing, how it has dropped and how the processing power has actually increased. So you will see disks. Not too long ago, about 25 years ago, when you bought a hard disk, I still remember buying a hard disk that had 20 megabytes of disk space. Okay? And then there were disks used to have gigabytes, now they have terabytes. Okay? Three orders of magnitude improvement. Okay? So memory this has gone the same way. You used to buy PCs which had RAM in megabytes, now you buy them in gigabytes. Okay? Another three orders of magnitude. Same thing, reduction in cost. We have gone to now $500 PCs and $200 tablets and whatnot. Okay? That are probably more processing power than PCs in those days. So all of this is basically a consequence of what is called Moore's law. Yeah, I don't know if you learnt about Moore's law in 230. Anyone know what Moore's law is? Anyone know who Moore is, first of all? Before you know who Moore's law is. He's still alive. It's Moore's law is named after Gordon Moore. He's one of the stalwarts of computing. Came up with lots of good ideas, and Intel came out of some of what he did long time ago. But basically, what Moore's law says is essentially every other year, the amount of computing power that you can put in a chip is going to double. That's because the technology is improving such that you can pack more transistors on a chip. You can do more computing using that chip. Okay, so the essential consequence is every other year you can get a 2x increase in your computing power. There used to be a time where this improvement essentially resulted in faster and faster machines. Okay, you would have a 500 megahertz CPU, then you could get a 1 gigahertz CPU, 2 years later you got a 2 gigahertz CPU. But essentially what happened after a while is that this Moore's law still exists, but this trend has changed how chips have evolved. Because as the speed of chips has increased, so is the heat that they generate. So if they generate more heat, that means you need more cooling to cool the same chip. So what happens now is rather than doubling the speed of the chip, you essentially put more cores on the chip. You put more tiny elements. So instead of getting a dual core machine, 2 years from now you should be able to buy a quad core machine for the same price. Okay, and 2 years later you should be able to buy an 8-core machine. You see this now in smartphones. If you actually track the trend, you see that 2 years ago everybody was talking about, or maybe 4 years ago, were single core smartphones. Okay? Then there were dual core smartphones. Now everybody is talking about quad core smartphones. Right? What you do with 4 cores on your phone, I still don't know. There's only so many text messages you can send, but nevertheless, that's the trend. Okay? So that's basically a consequence of this Moore's law. Something you should know. If you are a computer scientist, you better know what Moore's law is. And the simplest way to state it is every other year, the amount of computational power on a chip is going to double because of technology trends that allow you to put more transistors on that chip. Okay, so this basically history lesson is saying, I mean, doubling every 2 years is an exponential increase. Okay, it's not a linear increase, it's an exponential. So 4 years from now, there's factor of 4 and 16 and so on. So whenever you have exponential growth, that results in really interesting consequences. So if you actually look at what has happened in the field of computing, there is essentially no parallel. Okay? Computing and communication are basically what you have seen because of Moore's law. Nothing else, that no other technology that humans have invented, have actually gotten this exponential growth in improvement. Okay? It's essentially the only two fields. And you basically want to see what exponential growth does. If you want to basically see what zooming, this is another visual way of figuring out what exponential growth does. So if this is one order of magnitude, that same photo is here, one order of magnitude smaller, it's two orders of magnitude, so that's that dot there. Okay. So think of this picture as pixels and pixels as transistors. So you're packing more and more. So what you could do here, with one generation has actually now gotten this, so you basically have this much more computation on this chip. Your transistors are pixels, and here is two orders, and then you have three orders, you have four orders, this is five, six, seven, this is eight, and that's nine. Okay, that's what we have gotten in 40 years. Okay, so you can imagine what that means in terms of technology. Okay. Now, if you look at some of the research literature, it says Moore's law is running out of steam. That's not quite true, because what has actually happened, as I said, is you can always pack more computation, but you have to deal with heat issues. So it's how to deal with heat is the problem, not that you can pack more computation. So there have been different artifacts that people have developed, just multi-core computing and whatnot, as a result to deal with it. Yes, question.
Yeah, I think the other problem is like the size of batteries and trying to make that smaller.
Yes, so if you have more computation, it requires you, if you are running devices that run on batteries as opposed to things that are plugged into the wall, you have to deal with battery life, right? If every 2 years the thing has four twice as much computing power, then it's going to require that much more juice. That means batteries haven't actually improved at the same pace. This is another problem. You don't get batteries that are twice the capacity every 2 years. They have seen linear growth. This is why doing this design choices well is important. You can get quad-core Android phones 2-hour battery life. Right? There's not much use because you can put a lot of computation, but if you don't have battery to run the phone, not good design choice. Okay? Not to mean that Android is bad, I just mean that the hardware design choices there were bad. Okay. So in any case, I think there are lots of interesting hardware features that have come up with technology improvements, and what that has meant is operating systems have had to evolve. Okay? they haven't stayed the same. I mean, as you have more hardware improvements, OSs have evolved to be have more functionality, sometimes do things that you couldn't do before, and so on and so forth. So what we want to do in this course is essentially understand how to design these operating systems well, how to evolve them with new hardware choices, and we'll see some of that. In file systems, we'll see how file systems have evolved from traditional hard disk to solid state devices, what has changed as the hardware has changed, and things like that. So that's where we will leave it for today. So we have 15 minutes to go. So I'll stick around. The class is done for day. If you have any questions about the course, come talk to me now.